It's one thing to listen to doom and gloom about food and fertilizer shortages, skyrocketing prices, the cost of living, or your job being outsourced overseas or eliminated due to automation. It's quite another thing to hear practical, immediately actionable advice from experts who can help you reduce the fear, anxiety, and burden of these problems.
Tune in now to the Surviving Hard Times podcast from the Finding Genius Foundation with Richard Jacobs. Before we begin, a note from our sponsor. I'm Richard Jacobs, Executive Director of the nonprofit Finding Genius Foundation and host of the Finding Genius podcast. In late 2016, I was rear-ended at 65 miles an hour by a truck on the highway, which sent me off-road into a ditch. The impact of the collision gave me a concussion and other injuries. At the hospital, a CT scan showed that I had thyroid nodules, which turned out to be cancer. It was then, when I had a biopsy in my neck, that I realized even if I was a millionaire, I wouldn't want a second or a third biopsy due to the pain and the invasiveness of it. And appointments at that time for thyroid experts were 3 to 6 months out, and I was worried about dying now, even if that was irrational. So because of this, I've decided to raise money to conduct a literature review on steroids, on the causes of anxiety and depression, a condition that affects well over 50 million people in the United States and hundreds of millions worldwide. Our goal is to create a codex, a guide, that reveals all possible treatments for anxiety and depression for people that live with the condition, or for loved ones that have it, as my wife and my son do. To find out more about our fundraiser, visit findinggeniusfoundation.org and click on Current Initiatives. And now, to our guest. Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Surviving Hard Times podcast, sponsored by the Finding Genius Foundation.
I got a really great guest today, Joel Salatin. He runs what's called Polyface Farms. He's just been an integral force in regenerative agriculture for I'm not sure how many years, but I've seen some of his books out there and watched some of his videos, and he's a really, really, really knowledgeable speaker about all food-related items. So, Joel, thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure. Delighted to be with you.
Yeah, if you would, tell me a bit about your background. How did you get to where you are today, and you know, what was it like before this?
It's always hard to know where to start. But since we have such an unusual background, I'm going to start a little farther back than most with my grandfather, who was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it first came out in whatever, 1948. He held this big organic garden and all that. And so my dad got, you know, that kind of ecological, non-chemical bent from him. And I got it from dad. So, you know, I don't have a conversion story. I was born unorthodox in my DNA, I guess. And so after World War II, dad went to Venezuela with Texas Oil Company as a bilingual accountant to make enough money to buy a farm in Venezuela, which he did after 7 years. And then we started raising chickens and selling them there. And we had this farm, but because our chickens were clean and the indigenous ones had snot. They had a nasal drip because of the unhygienic conditions they were all raised in the open sewer pots and all that stuff, that dad quickly cornered the market, and everybody thought we were doing voodoo and witchcraft. So we got accused of that. And then the junta came in 1959 of Petit Jimenez, and basically the machine guns came in the front door as we went out the back door and lost everything and came back to the U.S. So then we landed here in Virginia, Shenandoah Valley, on the cheapest, most eroded, gullied rock pile that we could find, and started over in 1961. So the first 10 years were devoted to, you know, experimentation. Dad sought counsel from everyone. How do I make a living on this farm? And it was all, you know, buy fertilizer, plant corn, build silos, borrow more money, graze the woodlot, all of which he was opposed to. He was an accountant. So as an accountant, he understood, you know, margins and that as a small farm, we had to wear the middleman hats by branding and direct selling into the retail market. So, at 10 years old, I got my first chickens and started selling them in the community to people at church, sold it. We had a couple restaurants, a couple schools. We joined a local kind of it was a precursor to today's farmers markets, the curb market. So from 14 to 18, I was up every Saturday morning of the year. It was a year-round indoor market. And by the time I joined at 14, there were only two elderly matrons and me. And those two grandmas took me under their wing and I'll tell you what, I wouldn't trade those 4 years of their tutelage and that direct marketing, that retail experience for anything. Well, then when I went off to college, nobody else in the family wanted to do it. And so, you know, so we closed it down. By the time I came back from college, that market was done. The beauty of that market was it had been grandfathered in so that if I joined 4-H and a woman joined the Home Extension Homemakers Club, we could sell anything without inspection. So we could sell butter and buttermilk and quiche and pot pies and beef. We could process beef in the backyard, sell it by the cut, grind it up. We could sell sausage and pepperoni and you know, anything without any inspection. And so I grew up with that kind of freedom, knowing what was potential. We were about 20 years ahead of our time. And so, you know, by the time I came back and the market was closed, that grandfathering was done. And now I'm thinking, all right, I want to farm. How do I get here full time? And I realized I could milk 10 cows, sell the milk at just regular retail supermarket prices, make a good living on this little farm. There was only one problem. It was illegal and there was no exemption, no nothing, you know, that you could do to try to circumvent that. And so, you know, I ended up going, working at a local newspaper for a couple of years, saved up a little nest egg, got married, built a apartment in the attic. We had a big garden. We lived on $300 a month, drove a $50 car and didn't have a TV, still don't have a TV. We didn't go anywhere, but we were able to save up a little nest egg to where I was able to leave outside employment, came back to the farm full time September 24, 1982. And by that time, we had done a lot of experimentation with compost, animal movement, portable infrastructure, and different things to where we were actually feeling pretty comfortable that if we could get here full time, we could actually make a living. And so we did jump off that cliff. And again, in September 24, 1982, and that little nest egg just kept on holding and kept on holding. I thought we'd run through it in a year, but we didn't. It held on for a couple, 3 years, and we were able to build up a little reputation in the area, get some customers, develop a brand, and start a direct marketing. And here we are now in 2022, supporting 25 salaries, some 10,000 families, 40 or 50 restaurants, and it's become a crazy thing. But
wow, so 40 years and yeah, your farm is still going, and that's it, supports right, a lot of people. Wow,
that's right, it is. And right now there are four generations. Mom is still here, and then there's us, and then our son Daniel runs day-to-day operations, and then we have our three grandchildren here as well. So we're pretty excited to have four generations on the farm right now, and it's good. So, you know, we did a lot. The rock piles, the gullies the erosion has stopped. We've built soil on rocks that were just bare rocks. We have soil now up over them that's grown up over them over the years. And what used to feed 10 cows now feeds 100. The abundance and the ability to heal is beyond imagination. And, you know, I'm not that old, but I've seen in my lifetime that degree of response to correct management. And it gives me great optimism.
Yeah, one thing I'm sure you're probably much more aware of than I am, but, you know, a lot of people are starting to talk about coming food shortages and global famine, which is crazy. If other farmers and other governments implemented your methods in the various countries, how much do you think we could mitigate the coming starvation if it's real?
Well, believe me, nobody's going to go hungry because there isn't enough resource. Right now, almost half of human edible food on the planet is thrown away because it's either got a little blemish or a sell-by date or spoiled, or, you know, packaging got broken. Human civilization has never thrown away the level of food we do in the world today. So nobody in the world right now goes hungry because there's not enough food. They go hungry because of geopolitical, social, political issues. You know, a warlord won't let a Red Cross truck go across the road in Pakistan or Africa or whatever. And so all of the hunger issues are not because there's not enough food. It's because there are glitches in the distribution program. Now, that being said, certainly there are places that are stressed. You know, desertification is increasing, but through proper design and permaculture principles, we can absolutely mitigate, if not eliminate, those kinds of dry conditions, desert conditions. We can hydrate places that you would never imagine could be hydrated, and people are doing it. It is being done. And so trust me, if anybody goes hungry, it will not because the sun quit shining and the rain quit raining. It'll be because of, you know, socio-political issue. It'll be because of some sort of non-resource related issue.
Okay. How big of a role is regulation and maybe over-regulation playing in different communities being able to feed themselves properly?
Oh, well, you just put your finger on probably one of the single biggest reasons for supply shortages, and that is regulation. So, you know, it's such a big topic, it's hard to know where to start. I'll just throw out one idea that, of course, you know, we've all now lived through 2020 and the whole COVID thing and the empty store shelves and the things that were going on there. And I would simply ask everybody, you know, we'll just say the U.S., forget the world, but just the U.S., if rather than having, you know, 150 to 300 mega 5,000 employee processing facilities for our food system, if instead we had had 150 to 250,000 community-based, you know, 20 to 50 per employee processing facilities. This is, you know, slaughterhouses, canneries, you know, whatever. Do you think we would have weathered 2020 far better? And I think all of us, I have not met a person yet that thinks that centralized, concentrated food systems actually serve people better. Almost everybody realizes, no, it'd be a lot better if we decentralized, democratized the access, democratized the market, and had a lot more, you know, small scale community or neighborhood scale abattoirs, canneries, food hubs, and things like that. And so what keeps this from happening is that the regulations, the food regulations, this is everything from slaughter to canning green beans to, you know, making hot pockets. All of the regulations are size prejudicial. In other words, they are much easier to comply if you're large scale than if you're small scale. And I take great philosophical umbrage with the very notion that you would have regulations that are size prejudicial. So somebody says, well, what's an example of one that's not size prejudicial? Well, a good example, I think, is the speed limit. It doesn't take any more effort to put your foot on the brake of an 18-wheeler than your foot on the brake or the gas pedal of a Prius, right? And so, you know, that's a non-prejudicial regulation. And so what happened, I mean, here's a great example. Let's say that in order to have to comply with food regs on to make, say, let's say charcuterie, you have to have a $2,000 thermometer that's a 24/7, you know, a double redundant thing. You know, $2,000 thermometer to verify temperature, you know, that's a spit in the ocean if you're making a tractor trailer load of charcuterie. But if you're making a 5-gallon bucketful, that $2,000 thermometer just stopped your business. And so this is exactly, just take that over pretty much anything, any food item you can imagine. And that's what we have. We have these onerous, tyrannical, capricious, and, you know, I don't want to say malicious, but they seem that way sometimes, but certainly capricious and prejudicial regulations. The last time I testified before Congress, it was a hearing called by Congressman Dennis Kucinich when he was a congressman from Ohio. And it was after that, that undercover video uncovered that slaughterhouse in California that was, you know, spraying the cows with fire hoses and hitting them with forklifts to try to get them up so they'd walk into the knock box. And they convened this thing. And the question is, you know, what can we do about the meat system in the U.S.? And I was one of, I think, 12 who testified that day. They called me. And the first guy who took, you know, about 2 hours of the day was the the commissioner of the Food Safety Inspection Service, the federal top meat inspector. And I was appalled at how he sat there and told those congressmen how efficient the FSIS had come, because it had been able to push out of business thousands of community-based neighborhood small-scale slaughterhouses. And now an inspector in the big industrial facilities, an inspector could see way more pounds of meat per hour than one in a small facility. And I'm sitting there thinking, wait a minute, I thought they were supposed to be inspecting for safety and quality. I didn't know that they were supposed to inspect. I didn't know that they had some sort of a pounds per hour, stipulation. I've never seen that in any of the regs. And yet, why should I be surprised that an outfit that is completely industrial based also has an industrial mindset about throughput and flow through. I didn't know we were competing, that we had a NASCAR competition to compete on who could do more pounds faster. I thought what we wanted was clean, safe product, not how fast can you run it through. So, the whole food safety deal is a crock, and it's important for us to appreciate that it's not, it's not what it's cracked up to be. You can go out and shoot a deer on a 70-degree day, drag it through the squirrel dung and the sticks and rocks, and promenade it through town on the front of your blazer in the afternoon sun, take it home, bring it up in your backyard, cut it out and feed it to your family and all of your friends, and you're a great patriotic American. But if you take an appropriate temperature day and do a cow and sell a pound of hamburger to your neighbor, suddenly, you're a criminal. And so this is obviously not about food safety. It's about market access. And so if we actually opened up market access, so that I'll just conclude by saying that if you and I, as voluntary consenting adults, could exercise freedom of choice for the fuel for our microbiome, without a bureaucrat being involved, we would have an explosion of small scale community neighborhood food alternatives and food systems that would ameliorate any kind of food chain issues that we have. That ultimately is the answer. The answer is not government involvement. The answer is government disinvolvement to allow the latent entrepreneurial community-based food system to flourish instead of trying to choke it out of business, which is what all the government regulations do.
What kind of products are the most heavily regulated or overregulated? I know raw milk, I see it here now in Texas in some places, but I'd heard it was illegal in a lot of places. Selling meat versus selling vegetables versus selling eggs, which areas are the most regulated versus not so much?
Well, certainly the most regulated is dairy. There's no question about that. After dairy would come meat, beef and pork. And then after meat and pork would come poultry. Poultry enjoys a couple of little, small exemptions. And then you have the whole value added thing, where if you, for example, we can process 20,000 chickens a year without being inspected. It's a wonderful, wonderful exemption. It ought to be extended to the same amount of, butter and cheese and beef and pork and other things. This exemption has been in place since 1967. And I don't know of anybody that's gotten hurt or sick or whatever from, due to this exemption. Why? Because farmers that use this exemption, there's a numerical exemption. It's direct market. You can't sell to Walmart and Kroger's. So there's a direct, a direct customer relationship. There are stipulations on it, but that make sure that it's small scale and direct market and transparent between, producer and consumer. But where they really get you is in the value added, where you're making, things like charcuterie, hot dogs, sticks, snack, like meat snack sticks, you know, anything that's value added, chicken broth, you know, pot pies, meat pies, those, you know, pickles, you know, canned tomatoes, any of that kind of value added material, that really run into problems.
So if I sell you a tomato versus sell you a can of tomato sauce, it's totally different in terms of regulation.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Anyone can pull off on the side of the road anywhere in the U.S. and sell a tomato to anybody. No questions asked, no inspection whatsoever. But as soon as I take that tomato and I either slice it, put it on a sandwich, can it, freeze it, do anything besides an unsliced, I mean, this is the thing. Farmers markets, you know, a lot of problems at farmers markets, farmers have that are selling like cantaloupes and succulent things like that. You know, they can sell a cantaloupe, but they can't slice it and offer you know slices to people to try. This isn't even a sale. This is just a sample. But the position of the health department in most cases is if you slice that, now that's a value added product. Which goes under manufacturing, and suddenly, you know, it's not actually food; it's a manufactured item. I mean, this is why, for example, at our farm, we're zoned agriculture here, and so you know, we have a sawmill. We can mill logs into lumber for buildings and things like that. But if I take one of those boards that I've milled from my own tree and make it into a chair, it's illegal for me to sell that because that's manufacturing, and manufacturing is illegal in an agriculture zone.
So, jeez, that's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, of course it's crazy. Of course, no reasonable person could come up with any of this stuff. But you know, the bureaucracy is not reasonable, and certainly the consumer advocacy people that are paranoid of somebody, you know, pulling a fast one on them, and they want a bureaucrat to protect them from any kind of poor business decisions. You know, that's what drives this stuff. And at the end of the, I mean, and these folks get paid to sit in a cubicle and dream up more verbiage. And it just, you know, it just grows like a cancer every year.
Crazy. Yeah. I remember in New York, I don't know if it's still in place, but you know, if bagel stores wanted to sell bagels, they couldn't slice them. Cause if they did, it was a value add and they had to pay tax, and it was just ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the kind of thing, and you know, you shake your head, but as a small business, think about, look, a lot of customers want them sliced, right?
Right. And
so one of the first items of business is meet the customer, right? You don't sit there and shake your fist in the customer's face. You say, hey, this is the way you want it, we'll give it to you. If you want it cubed, you know, how do you want it? We'll make it. We'll be customer friendly here. But you know, but the bureaucracy does not recognize that kind of, you know, Adam Smith, you know, called it the invisible hand of the marketplace to guide, you know, to guide both people in the transaction to get what they want, the seller to get what they want and the buyer to get what they want. And so we're, you know, we're stuck. I'll tell you, one of the most interesting or whatever, shocking things, I guess, I ever had. I was speaking at a college in California a few years back, and I had 300 students in this lecture hall, and I asked for a show of hands. I said, how many of you, we kind of got onto this topic, and I asked, how many of you think that it is that you should have a food safety inspector check out vegetables from your own garden before you can eat them? And a third of the hands went up. Yeah. I was speechless. I just shook my head. I mean, that's what we're up against.
That's crazy. Well, I guess the topic of regulation is pretty depressing, and I do want to get some practical advice for people. So what, you know, for someone that's never, I don't know, grown anything, done anything, but is concerned about, you know, better health and maybe more food security going forward, what are some things that they can do to help themselves?
Oh, sure. It's a wonderful question. Yeah. And you're right. The regulatory discussion is depressing. However, there is a movement in the U.S. called the Rogue Food Conference. We're doing two of them a year, and we're showcasing all the people who have circumvented rather than complied to try to bring cleverness and genius, if you will, to, you know, to how do we circumvent this stuff instead of comply? You know, so it's time to have a different tack. But what can an average person do to make sure that, you know, they've got their food and their health up and running? Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to start being intentional and interested in your personal responsibility in this space. What we have right now is I think the average person thinks, well, I'll just eat whatever's convenient, whatever's cheap, whatever's convenient. And if something happens, I'm expecting the drug companies to fix me or the surgeon to fix me. And so the first thing that people have to do is understand my health is my responsibility. It's not the government's responsibility. In fact, it's not even the doctor's responsibility. It's my responsibility. So if I'm going to do that, well, first of all, let's stop doing the junk and let's stop doing better. So I'm not going to drink any stuff that's harmful, like, you know, Coca-Cola. I'm not going to go to McDonald's. I'm not going to, you know, eat monosodium glutamate and high fructose corn syrup and processed food and you know, Cheerios and you know, Fruit Loops and that sort of, I mean, that stuff's like it's poison. And so what we're going to do is we're going to stop the poison and then we're going to substitute good stuff. That means we're going to buy from farmers who build soil instead of erode soil. We're going to buy from farmers who are biologically oriented and not chemically oriented. We're going to buy stuff that actually, you know, decomposes. I mean, you take Velveeta cheese and squirt it on the table, you can walk away from it for a year and it doesn't mold, it doesn't change, it doesn't do anything. You take real cheese, put it on your table, and in 5 days, it's got 3 inches of mold, sprouts legs, and walks off the table. I mean, that's, you know, that's what your body wants. Listen, if it won't decompose, it won't digest. And yet when we look at our food system, the whole food industry is all predicated on extended shelf life. You know, how do we make it shelf stable? How do we make it last forever? And we want to extend instead of the fragility that comes with easy digestion. And so, you know, when it comes to meat, we're looking for farms that have animals out on pasture, not confined, and we don't want any animals in confinement buildings and in factory farms. And so we're looking for those pastured opportunities. What you can do personally is you can do something yourself, even if it sprouts some, you know, some alfalfa sprouts or mung beans in a quart jar on your windowsill. You can have a vermicomposting kit under your sink and grow and feed your kitchen scraps to worms and take the castings and grow, feed that to a PVC hanging vertical herb garden in a pocketed PVC hanger on your front porch, you know. And yeah. Some people put wind chimes. You can hang these pocketed PVC gardens. The number of urban food production things that are now available are incredible. In fact, my last book was Polyface Micro, where I microed down everything that we do here. And I have a whole chapter on how to have rabbits and chickens in a Manhattan apartment with no without making any smells. And so you can absolutely do this stuff, but it starts by changing what's between your ears, getting your mindset intentional and interested about what I'm going to do to change the thing. The biggest problem or the hurdle that people face is I want a different world, but I don't want to have to do anything to make it a different world. I want to keep doing what I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And I want everybody else to change. And so we tend to say, well, if those people over there would do that, and if this guy would do that, and if those congressmen would pass this, and if, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we're always pointing out there. But the reality is that wherever we are in society is a physical manifestation of what we've been doing and choosing for the last, whatever, several generations. We didn't get here overnight. We won't get out overnight, but we can start overnight. And we can start feeding a different dog. We can start creating a different path and a different trajectory so that 40 years from now, our children look back and say, oh, you know, we have a better world today because of decisions that mom and dad and grandma and grandpa made, you know, 40 years ago. Wouldn't that be cool instead of being where we are and saying we got all these, you know, problems because, you know, people didn't care if soil eroded. They didn't care if water was polluted. They didn't care if we, you know, used the extra petroleum. They didn't care if the trees got all buggy and crooked and junky and all burned up in forest fires. You know, at some point it takes a different mindset.
So, you know, what do you think would be the absolute minimum that someone can do to improve their health and to kind of, you know, to start to connect with where food comes from? Like, for instance, you know, if they had, they just had a little tray of microgreens and they ate them twice a day, they put it into their regular food, you know, would that make any difference, you think, in their health? Would that start to do anything for them and connect them to the food system?
Yes, absolutely it would. So, you know, I have a layman's recipe kind of for, you know, for increasing your immunity, for building up your immunity, which is another way of saying building up your health. And it starts by, you know, stop eating the junk. Next, start eating good stuff. And your microgreen idea is a great idea, especially if you're not going to McDonald's anymore and get Coca-Cola, Dr. Pepper, and all the Mountain Dew and all the high fructose corn syrup out of your house. So, you know, it's getting rid of the bad, instituting the good. Then the next thing is to get out in the sun 20 minutes a day. You know, we don't get enough sun. You gotta get out and the sun is a wonderful thing. And then exercise. You know, I think you should try to sweat 20 minutes a day, work up a sweat. I don't care if it's running in place, doing yoga, standing on your head, jogging around the block. I mean, for me, it's, you know, it's running a chainsaw, digging a fence post hole, you know, carrying water buckets, throwing firewood, you know, it's just regular farm work, gardening, worked up a sweat this morning, picking blueberries, you know, but work up a sweat. Few things pull the toxins and the pathogens out of your body like sweat. So embrace it, love it, you know, get with it. Then next thing is sleep 8 hours a night. You know, we don't sleep enough. We stay up late for the late show and then we get up and we depend on coffee to get us going. You know, a little known fact about me is that, you know, I'm 65. I have never drunk one single cup of coffee in my life. Now, I'm not saying coffee's evil. I'm just saying that, you know, depending on caffeine to keep you up and going, cause you stayed up to 11 last night watching the late show, has a long-term, you know, effect. And then drink water. We're all dehydrated. I mean, Americans are unbelievably dehydrated, and partly it's because our city water tastes so bad. So if you get a good, you know, water filter and start getting some decent water that tastes good, that you enjoy drinking, you know, you ought to drink certainly more than half a gallon a day. Every single day, get yep. rehydrated. There's a lot of evidence that is a big deal. And then another huge one is humor, laughing. You know, our problem is we watch too much news and get frustrated and depressed and don't offset it with, you know, with comedy. And so I don't care whether you read a joke book or watch, you know, watch funny stuff, but laugh uproariously, you know, 20 minutes a day. My thing is, you know, if you want to watch about an hour of news a week, that's probably about all you need. And then 5 hours of comedy, you know, so you laugh yourself silly. And it's okay if you're laughing by yourself, you know, that's fine. But humor. And then, you know, kind of my final one, in this kind of recipe of immunity and health is make a list of everybody that has done you wrong or that you dislike or you hate or whatever, and forgive them. Forgiveness is one of the most stress relieving things possible. When we've got this stuff, well, I'd like to get even with that person. Oh, I'd like to, you know, and we kind of carry this resentful, vengeful spirit in us because we've got this, you know, list of people that have crossed us. There are few things that feed stress as much as that kind of thing. So just, you know, just make a list and get rid of it. Just it's gone. Get rid of it. You know, everybody's different and they did me wrong, but you know, life goes on. It's okay. And I'm not dwelling on it. And that's one of the best things you can do. So that's kind of my recipe for, you know, for health and immunity. And it's, you know, it's simple, but I think there's a lot of wisdom in it.
So people don't have to go it alone. What are there typical types of organizations, or what should people seek out so they also get some community along with doing their gardening and, you know, growing their own food, you know, at whatever level they choose? Where can they go to?
Sure. Well, what a great thing, because you're exactly right. When you start, whatever, walking to the beat of a different drummer, it gets pretty lonely very quickly. And of course, people start laughing at you. Oh, what are you, become a food snob? You know, you got all that stuff. So, you know, there's the Weston A. Price Foundation. There are numerous organizations and, you know, sustainable ag, local food initiatives. You know, just the point is you've got to seek for this the way you seek for the right college for your kids, the right small engine mechanic for your lawnmower, the right doctor for your surgery. You know, we don't have any problem investing hours, you know, sleuthing and vetting all those things. We just don't sleuth and vet our food. We go, we get whatever's cheap, whatever's easy. And I would suggest that our food provenance probably should be, you know, above all those others. And you got to put some attention on it. But yeah, there are communities. Every state has, you know, sustainable ag or biological farming organizations. And in New England, it's New England Organic, NOFA, New England Organic Farmers Association. There's all sorts of things like that. There's, again, the Weston A. Price Foundation is probably the, you know, the best one for, you know, for traditional foods and healthy eating. But there's homestead festivals. Good grief! There's Homesteaders of America in the Carolinas now. There's the Farm Where You Live festivals. All of these are people that are embracing self-reliance, health without drugs, and it's the tribe. You know, it's a tribe, and you just have to find that tribe. They're everywhere, and they're all ready to hold your hand, coach, help, and inspire you to, you know, to go past where you think you can go by yourself.
Yeah, that's great. I think I had read that at one point you had tours of your farms, or is that not accurate? Or if people want to see farms, and, you know, literally get a, you know, take a class or again, get involved, where can they go?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'm always careful to do, you know, self-promotion or shame, that kind of stuff. That's lest I be perceived as mercenary, but for sure, you know, here at Polyface, we offer, you know, tours that they're called, I'm the lunatic farmer, so they're the lunatic tours. We do seminars, we do gatherings. Shoot, just last weekend, we had our annual 2 days of truth with all sorts of unorthodox healing methodologies. And we did it last year. We plan to do it again next year. We have coming up, we have God's Good Table in 3 or 4 weeks where we'll have, you know, talks about, you know, good food provenance, how to cook it, how to, you know, how to grow it, how to keep it, all those kinds of things. So, you know, we have these gatherings coming on. There's going to be one, you know, Homesteaders of America is going to meet here. So, you know, we have these farm gatherings right along through the season with different topics, different things. So, yeah, and it is absolutely a tribe. I mean, they're obviously very different themes, some of them, but it's all promoting, I would simply say, you know, the road less taken. You know, two roads converged in the woods. I took the one less traveled by. It's all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's excellent. What are you seeing as happening with the, you know, the food supply and the supply chains over the next, you know, let's say year? Do you have any more insight, you feel, than other people, because you're so, you know, ingrained in the food industry?
Yeah, well, so what I'm seeing, I've never been so excited about where we're headed. Let me just say that what COVID did was that it gummed up the works for for very large scale outfits. Now, I've already said that the regulations favor the large scale outfits, that's for sure. But what happened was the logistics within these large outfits became much, much more difficult, because when you have, 2,000 people in damp concrete, no sunlight walls all day, you simply have an incubator for pathogens of all sorts, whether it's COVID or anything else. And not only do you have the threat of spread of vectors, but you also then have the threat of litigation, human resources. I mean, these folks, they have now spent billions of dollars ramping up their human resource department to keep up with, Mac over in zone 5, he had COVID. So who worked with him last week? All right, all you guys take off work for 2 weeks. And not only do you lose that time, paying for not working, but you gum up the works. And so my epiphany occurred, about 3 months ago when a lady walked in the farm store. We sell beef, pork, chicken, all sorts of stuff here. And I heard this lady kind of gasp. She looked in the meat case. And I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Well, I was just at Costco and sirloin steaks there, $16 a pound, and yours is $9 a pound." And the lights went off, and we've always been a little more expensive than the regular supermarket. And then I'm looking at Wall Street Journal, and I see that, Tyson's raised their beef prices 32% in the last 12 months. We've only raised ours 10%. And so what's happening is, These massive big outfits are starting to, they've always said, "Well, we're more efficient. But that efficiency is turning into fragility when you have rocky waters and rocky shoals. And so our little speedboat can navigate better through these disturbing times, and we can adjust a lot better. I don't wake up every morning wondering, "Oh man, I wonder who's going to sue us today because we didn't do the right COVID protocol, or we didn't quarantine the right person for the right number of days. Who's going to call, the Fair Labor, the government, bureaucracy, and turn us in for violating some?" I don't even think about that. But I can tell you, big businesses do. They live on that edge and then that dread every single day, and it's simply grinding things down, making it more expensive, more laborious, more difficult to get anything done. So those of us who are small scale, able to navigate this, we're able to be nimble. There's a business book out. It's not the big that eats the small. It's the fast that eats the slow. And we know that nimbleness in business is certainly as important as efficiency. So now efficiency in the business world is being replaced by the word resilient. And people are realizing, if at first you're not resilient and you don't survive, then you don't have anything to be efficient about. And so resilience is now, coming over. So, here we've got, Russia not sending, fertilizer, Ukraine not sending wheat. And we look at all this stuff and we just laugh because we don't buy any fertilizer. We don't buy anything from Ukraine. We get it from local farmers here, GMO free. And we've got a tight, close supply chain. And we don't depend on these things. We don't buy any fertilizer. And fuel, we use something like 300% less per dollar of sales than the average farm. And so, when you put all those together, our resilience is just at this point in history and time, our resilience is extremely affirming. And I'm hearing and seeing the same thing with farmers like us, around the country. And we're all, real excited about the changes that have been made that are going to make people start to think about things, including their health. I mean, look, when things go down and you can't get to a doctor and you can't, gas is expensive and the wheels fall off, you don't want to be sick. If there's one thing you don't want, to be sick in difficult times. So this is driving a lot of renewed interest in this. Okay, how do I really make sure that I stay good and healthy during these days? The whole goal here is that you know, if we all wanted to sit down and make a list of the things we're angry about, frustrated about, worried about, those kinds of things, it'd be a pretty big list today. So the idea is to take that list and invert it and say, yep, that's where things are going, but I'm going to invert that and use all that negative energy to develop creativity and innovation as antidotes to all that, so that I can be a part of the group that offers hope and help when everybody else feels hopeless and helpless.
Yeah, that's amazing, Joel. So for listeners that, you know, they don't know where to start, where do they start with you? Should they read your books or should they?
Well, I mean, certainly they can jump on our website, Polyface Farms. If you just Google in P-O-L-Y, it'll probably pop up, Polyface Farms. The website has a lot of material. It has, you know, I travel a lot and speak at presentations and things. You can see where I am. I've written 15 books. You can get them from us. You can get them from Amazon. You know, we do seminars, we do farm tours, we do gatherings. We're very active in this whole space. So yeah, our official, you know, reach out is the website polyfacefarms.com. And then, you know, I do a blog called Musings of the Lunatic Farmer. I do a podcast with Dr. Sheena McCullough called Beyond Labels. And so, yeah, we have a footprint there that's out there, and we welcome all comers, and we're delighted that you're interested in that.
Excellent. Well, Joel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been great to talk to you. I appreciate it.
I'm delighted and honored, and thank you very much. Thanks for giving me another platform to share.
Before you stop listening, ask yourself, what are one or two useful things you heard on this podcast that can help you overcome food and fertilizer shortages, skyrocketing prices, the cost of living, or your job being outsourced overseas or eliminated due to automation? Please like and subscribe and tell your friends and family about their Surviving Hard Times podcast. We're all going to need help now and in the near future.